Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now, race, faith, and your church. This will not be a comfortable conversation for some. No one wants to think that their faith community or leaders have been complicit in America's most shameful sin. But our guest, Jamar Tisby, writes in his new book, "Although the truth cuts like a scalpel and may leave a scar, it offers healing and health. The pain is worth the progress." As we consider the ways the churches have ignored, perpetuated, and even encouraged racism and racial inequity, I'd like you to consider your own experience in your faith community. Does your church truly stand for social and racial justice, or is there a gap between the talk from the pulpit and within the congregation and the walk? Have you found a faith community that truly lives its values on racism and equity? Or maybe you, as part of the congregation, are trying to push the conversation, push the discussion within your congregation. So I'd like to know where you think your church is on truly standing for social and racial justice, and what those discussions within the church, from the pulpit, within the congregation, within the members of the synagogue, within the members of the mosque, what does that sound like in your faith community? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Jamar Tisby is president of The Witness. It's a Black Christian collective. He's the author of the new book, The Color of Compromise, The Truth About the American Church's Complicity in Racism. And he joins us today from Memphis, Tennessee. Jamar, welcome. It's really good to have you back on the show.
Thank you again for having me back.
I imagine that this figurative scalpel that you've used in this research that you talk about is pretty distressing to a lot of Americans who have this enduring bond with their fellow congregants and their church. Will you explain why it isn't enough to say, well, my faith community gets it now, and that's enough for me?
One of the fundamental misunderstandings about how race and racism operates is that people, especially white evangelicals or theologically conservative Christians, really interpret race and racism in interpersonal terms only. And so it's using a racial slur or dressing up in a hood and burning crosses. Those kinds of things constitute what defines racism. And therefore, then the solution is, well, let me have a cup of coffee with someone who looks different, or some of my best friends are Black. Those kinds of things make people think that they are doing their part in combating racism. What's absent from those definitions, those interpersonal, individualistic definitions of race and racism, is the idea that these things function throughout systems, policies, practices, and institutions. And so for a church or a person to say, oh, I get it about race, we're beyond that now, I would challenge them to think of racism more broadly and say, well, what are you doing actually to combat the inequality that's actually baked into the way society operates in the United States? That's the real question in the 21st century.
You know, when you say institutions, again, I think this may prompt members of a faith community to say, there is nothing I can do about the way my church that I love behaved for decades. The fact that they were missing during the civil rights movement, the fact that they didn't step up in, you know, in this social justice. But I am working where I can and meeting people where they are. I think that's, in some ways, that complacency is what you're speaking to in this church, and I think that's, or in this book, and I think that's one of the most difficult things that we confront in our communities, in our faith communities. I'm just interested in how you read that.
That's precisely right. So I use in the title the words compromise and complicity. And that gets at the idea that it's not every Christian that's sort of a foaming at the mouth racist that's calling for, you know, black people to be deported and sent out of the United States because of their racism. That's not everyone. But in the opening chapter of the book, I talk about the tragic racial terrorist act where four little girls were killed in the 16th Street Birmingham church bombing. And what happened after that is significant. There was a white lawyer named Charles Morgan Jr. who gives a speech to an all-white male business club. And he asks the rhetorical question, who threw that bomb? And he answers it, and he says, we all did. And then he goes on to describe the ways that the community, the white Christian community in particular in Birmingham, had failed to challenge the overt racists and even the systems that promoted racism. And he said, in our failure to act and in the apathy that white Christians exhibited, they were complicit in fostering an environment that led to the heinous murder of four young black girls at a church. And in a similar way, we have to look at the way we are operating today, the ways that we say, well, it's not our problem or that's an issue of the past. And that very attitude can perpetuate racial inequality in America today.
Let me grab a call here from Liz in Minneapolis. Hi, Liz. Glad you called in. How are you hearing the conversation? How's it fit your life?
Hi, good morning. I have basically a couple of comments. One is, I was raised Jewish, and so I really hope that we can start talking about houses of worship instead of churches, because I do know the Jewish community here in the Twin Cities area does talk about, the white Jewish community does talk about racism and white privilege and racial justice. The second comment I have is, I am Quaker, and we are predominantly white religious group here in the United States. And locally, I'm part of a relatively small group of Quakers, white Quakers, who are wanting to engage more friends, as we're known colloquially, in the conversation. And there's this myth that Quakers are on the forefront of certain justice issues, including racial justice, and it's not true. A few of us were prominent, including Bayard Rustin, behind the scenes at March on Washington. And it seems to always be the case that a few people are given an awful lot of recognition, and therefore it's assigned, especially with white people. You know, we can do no wrong if one of us does well. Whereas, of course, it doesn't work that way if you're a person of color. If one person of color does something unkind or unfair, it's attributed to everybody.
Jamar, but, if I might, Liz, we do have some other calls, and I want to pick up on what you've just said there. Jamar, do you find that that's true? Liz saying there are people who take this on as a pretty personal mission in the church, and many other members of the church, the temple, the mosque, get to kind of float along on their wake. Do you find that's true?
I think that's a really insightful comment by Liz. First of all, as for the communities of faith and broadening that out to Jewish people and other communities of faith, there's absolutely an important histories to be told about race and other faith communities. This book is specifically focused on the American church and Christianity for various reasons. One, it's my area of study. And two, in many ways, America has been coded as a Christian nation. And so to begin to address that narrative head on, I wanted to talk explicitly about Christian faith communities. But that is certainly not to say that there's not important histories to be told elsewhere. Secondly, I think she's absolutely right. We have a tendency to have a triumphalistic view of race and religion in America, in that we will take these exceptional people or these small movements that did resist the status quo of white supremacy and racism and hold them up as representative of all people of faith or of all Christians, and ignore the reality that not only were they a small minority, but they faced incredible obstacles and persecution for their stances against racial inequality. And so I wrote this book called The Color of Compromise to say, yes, those stories are true, but here's been the reality for a far greater number of Christians, and we need to look at that reality head on.
Do you think what Dr. King said about segregation on Sunday morning, and we actually have the clip from Meet the Press here in just a second, do you think it remains true? Listen to how he put it.
I think it is one of the tragedies of our nation, one of the shameful tragedies, that 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is one of the most segregated hours, if not the most segregated hours in Christian America. I definitely think the Christian church should be integrated, and any church that stands against integration and that has a segregated body is standing against the spirit and the teachings of Jesus Christ.
He said that in 1960. Is it much different today?
I think the church is a bellwether for where the nation is in terms of race relations. And so the church stands as one of the still vital voluntary organizations in society. And you don't get the same press for integration through laws and other things that you would in, say, the corporate sector or entertainment even. And in other words, what I'm saying is people still sort of voluntarily pick and choose where they go to worship on Sunday morning. And those patterns, I think, tell us a little bit of something about how we view race relations. So the fact that we're still very segregated along racial lines, I think, tells a broader story, not really just about Sunday morning. I think Sunday morning is kind of the tip of the iceberg as to what's happening Monday through Saturday. And so the reason our churches are segregated on Sunday is because we live segregated lives Monday through Saturday. And that's the real issue there. I think what King was saying is an important dynamic of when he was speaking, there were churches intentionally barring black people from worshiping in their congregations, becoming members, or becoming leaders in the church. You don't see that as much today. But there is still the idea that white churches have really been designed around white people, and it's very difficult for people of color to enter into those spaces and retain their racial and cultural identity, dignity, and pride without feeling some pressure to conform to the dominant culture.
Johann says on Twitter, I left the church of my birth in part because when it came to healing the sick and serving the poor, they manifestly failed to do so. I know today that this failure was a result of the inherently racist belief held by many that the poor are lazy, dishonest, and undeserving. To the phones here to Nathan in Minneapolis. Hey, Nathan, thanks for waiting. What's your experience with this?
I think a lot of these churches are just like social gatherings. For instance, I'm a white man, and I attend a black church on the south side of Minneapolis, 38 Chicago, Worldwide Outreach for Christ. And it's a primarily black church, but I admire my pastor so much because he prays for Trump, because that's what the Bible tells us to do. You know, if you believe God has providence in everything, it tells us to pray for our leaders. And a fine example of providence in the church is the Civil War. You know, both the Confederacy and Union prayed to the same God. What side did God go with? Union. I mean, you just got to be patient, and God has providence over everything. And anyway, I was also, I'm so proud of my church at 38th in Chicago that, you know, I'm a white guy, and they, from day one, have treated me like the closest family. And I'm just giving that to you.
All right. Nathan, good to have the call. You know, Jamar, I was thinking about, since we played that clip from Dr. King, I was thinking about an issue today that really puts American churches, American Christian churches, to the test. And the one I thought of was the child separation issue at the border. And I thought, you can look around and see some of the way churches have responded and others who have exhibited, I think, the kind of complacency that you've written about in the book. Do you think that's an apt parallel to some of the historical racism and the complacency of the church? Is that a fair comparison?
I think we absolutely should look at the way churches are speaking up or remaining silent about present day justice issues, and especially as churches espouse sort of this idea of family values and promoting families and children and families staying together. Like, we can't apply that differentially based on one's country of origin. And, you know, in the political sphere, which is certainly closely aligned to the religious sphere, particularly evangelical Christianity, the line has been, well, these are quote unquote illegals. Even that term stripping the humanity subtly from other image bearers. And therefore, basically anything goes to protect our borders. But that's not a really consistent ethic of life. So if you're going to promote the solidarity of families in one sphere, you have to look at the way policies and even rhetoric may promote or deny that in other spheres. So I think we absolutely should say we're looking for consistency on these issues. And unfortunately, when it comes to Black and brown and poor people, many theologically and politically conservative Christians and churches have not been consistent, at least in terms of national leaders. I will say, though, there are churches even within those conservative spheres that did see a huge problem with this.
Definitely.
But unfortunately, many of those voices get drowned out.
I don't want to miss the fact that the Mormon Church, Baptist leaders, Catholic faith organizations spoke up and stepped in. But many, many churches didn't. Jamar, we have a lot of people on the phone lines. I'm going to go right back, if that's cool with you, to Connor. All right, good. Connor in Minneapolis. Hey, Connor, how are you thinking about this as you've listened to the discussion develop?
Yes, well, right before the break, he made an excellent point that some of the conservative voices of silencing some those who wish to speak of it. Now, I grew up Catholic. I still consider myself Catholic, but I have been to other church denominations. And when I see kind of the topic of racial injustice brought up, it usually only happens, and what I see, in extreme kind of circumstances, such as with the Philando Castile shooting a while back, where the Archbishop had a racial injustice mass event occur. But when it comes to the subject of kind of racial injustice and social justice in scope, mm-hmm. what I've seen usually is that the voices kind of get dimmed down or not heard as much, because I think there's a fear of where people feel that they got to sit and address some of the other issues that come within that sphere of things, such as gay rights and women's rights, something that can be very unappealing to many of those who have traditional or very conservative values. And so it's just like the old saying, once a camel pokes its nose in the tent or something, that you can't get it out. They're fearful of addressing hard issues that could encompass along with racial injustice.
I think this is a really great point that we haven't covered yet, Connor, so I appreciate that. The kind of can of worms thing, if we take this on, Jamar, well, what's the focus of the church going to become? Did you discover some of that as you were researching this?
Yes, I think there's a couple factors at play. One, as the caller indicated, is some churches and Christians think that if you take on the issue of racial justice, you have to take on this whole raft of issues that they may not agree with in terms of making progress on those issues. And so that does, I in my experience, cause a lot of people of faith, Christians in particular, to hesitate to get involved on this, because essentially they've labeled issues such as racial justice, or more broadly social justice issues, as quote unquote liberal. And in terms of both politics and theology, and then that would therefore disagree with their views on the Bible or the way society should operate. And so there's this hesitancy to get involved at all, because you have to take everything. It's all or nothing when it comes to social justice issues. But therein in itself is the second issue, which is what I think is an artificial bifurcation of what people would term the gospel and social justice, as if those are two separate issues and focusing on one will necessarily lead to the exclusion of the other. And if that's one's conception, then I would encourage folks to learn from the Black church tradition. And Black Christians learned Christianity in North America. This is certainly not where people of African descent were first introduced to Christianity. But in the context of North America, many Black Christians learned Christianity under the yoke of oppression, literally under the yoke of slavery. And so to them, stories of Exodus, the Exodus, were very real and very present. And there was no conception in which one's faith would not lead to actual physical material liberation. And so there wasn't this separation between the gospel and justice. They were part and parcel of the same endeavor of giving everyone human dignity and equality, which for people of African descent in North America meant literally getting free as well as getting spiritually free.
To the phones to Tyler in Savage. Hi, Tyler.
Good morning.
Hi. Good to have you call. What are you thinking about?
Yeah, I just, I'm an atheist, and I hypothesized like 5 years ago, and I was wondering if Lamar thought that perhaps the Christian doctrine itself was the problem, considering God as a moral arbiter explicitly endorses slavery and the genocide committed by Moses, Aaron, and Joshua all through the Middle East, and the antithesis of King's speeches were people using the exact same doctrine to promote those really bad ideas, and I was just curious how you reconcile those ideas, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you, guys.
It's a big question. Jamar, can you address it in the time we have?
There are many ways to address that question. One is theologically and the idea of human suffering and God's providence and what God wills or doesn't will. From a historical perspective, though, he mentions something that's very critical, that King's speeches are the antithesis of what many churches were promoting. And I think therein lies the contradiction. So on one hand, you do have Christians. I write about G.T. Gillespie, who was the president emeritus of Belhaven College, now University in Jackson, Mississippi. And he gives an address to a group of pastors called A Christian View of Segregation, where he uses the Bible to justify racial segregation. Now, this is right around Brown v. Board, and the next year in 1955, the Montgomery bus boycott begins in December. King becomes a civil rights leader of national prominence, and he speaks of the beloved community using those very same scriptures to justify racial equality. And again, learning from the Black church tradition, the historic Black church tradition, teaches us that people can see through the hypocrisy of folks who are motivated by money and greed and white supremacy, and then use the scriptures to justify hatred. And you can see folks, especially Black Christians, saying, no, that's not the authentic message that we're reading in the scriptures. This is a message of liberation, equality, freedom, and it helps us all get free of these pernicious ideas of a racial hierarchy. So I would look to the folks who have pushed back against hate, pushed back against inequality, and the way they've understood Holy Scriptures in order to promote and motivate their activism.
I think what you wrote in the section about how Christian churches responded to Martin Luther King's activism really shouldn't be missed. You write about this letter that is composed by Christian moderates of different faiths in the wake of the Birmingham, Alabama protests, and it really exemplifies the kind of complicity that we're talking about here. I mean, none of the people that signed their names to those letters would have said, yes, we believe that the racial discrimination that we're living in is just fine. But what you do point out is they were urging a go slow kind of don't rock the boat approach to it. And I sense in your book that you're saying, and that is how to understand the kind of complicity that the Christian church has been engaged in. Yes?
That's exactly right. So a lot of the focus is on King's letter from a Birmingham jail, but he's responding to white clergy people who lived in Birmingham, and they were actually involved in the fight for civil rights, and they were, but what they were saying in their letter to King was, let's go through the established systems, let's let local folks who are already involved in this keep doing what they're doing, let's be patient and essentially take an incremental approach to progress instead of all of these direct action, nonviolent techniques, the marches, the boycotts, people getting arrested. They're saying that's not helpful. And what King is saying is, no, 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 those things haven't worked. And the reality is that the very laws that you're saying will protect people and the very systems that you're saying we should work through are part of the problem. And that is fundamentally what he terms the racial moderate didn't understand. And in the meantime, as they're promoting this sort of go slow, gradual, incremental approach, King and other civil rights activists, I mention King frequently because he's just a popular touch point, but there were so many other people in the pantheon of civil rights activists who were saying the same things. He's saying that you can't put a timeline on another person's pain, that black people have been suffering in this country for centuries. And for you to say, as a white person and white clergy members, to say, go slow, be gradual, we're making progress, change is going to come, is fundamentally to deny the daily reality of oppression, marginalization, and suffering that people have and endure because of racism. So he's like, no, we got to do something. We got to do something now. And it's actually these racial moderates who are a bigger stumbling block, he says, than folks like the KKK.
Gianni says on Twitter, I'm Muslim, but I work with churches through homeless service organizations, and I see more racial issues addressed by mosques, but social justice through services like housing and food aren't, compared to how churches operate. If you've gotten in on the last bit of this conversation with Jamar Tisby, I recommend the book The Color of Compromise, The Truth About the American Church's Complicity in Racism, and I'm asking you to step in and talk to me about how your church copes with, discusses, addresses the racism and inequity in our culture today, some of the social justice issues that are clear and present in front of us today. Have you joined a congregation to say, it looks pretty homogenous, our conversation does not address this? Have you gotten involved with a faith community that you think exemplifies a lot of what we're talking about this morning? Here's the number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at @CarrieNPR to Kamal in Mendota Heights. Hi, interested in what you have to say. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, I think this is a good conversation today. Just the background of my question. We recently moved, like about 2 years now, moved in a very diverse community with a mid-sized church, and we visited a church is well diverse, and I was a little surprised to see on the background it's had all pastors or people in senior leadership were all Caucasian. So mm-hmm. I called the pastors or one of the leaders' attention to him and said, hey, this is a good church, but I just wonder why it's all, you know, especially the white males. And he said, oh no, we haven't had any qualified person yet to apply for somebody's position or vie for somebody's position, but it's something to consider. And we've been there for at least over a year and pretty much nothing has changed. And then similarly, this goes to even the African American or the other churches or other communities. If we want to have a diverse conversation or be able to have a conversation that will be able to address some of the issues that the speaker is talking about, we need to have a diverse community with some representation. I don't know what can he say about the leadership of these churches that he have visited?
Kamal, this is a good question at this point because, Jamar, you do have some ideas in the conclusion of the book for how to approach, how to make change, right? If this is something, because this is something that you as a member of a faith community are invested in. So give us some ideas about that.
Sure. So what I say in the book, The Color of Compromise, is that although it's a book about history, it's really about the present and the future of the church. So the final chapter is entitled The Fierce Urgency of Now, which comes from a phrase in King's I Have a Dream speech where he says, this is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. And he also says, we have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. And so the hope is that after reading chapter after chapter and hundreds of years of church history related to race and racism, folks would feel a burden to take action now. And I give a series of anti-racist actions at the end of the book. And I try to focus on things that go beyond the interpersonal. I do touch on that a bit, but I find that's not the sticking point for most people. It's these bigger structural issues like the caller just mentioned about diversity and leadership. And so for someone to say, well, we just haven't had any qualified applicants who have applied or that we can find, that actually to me speaks to a structural problem of your own social and professional networks are homogenous, because it simply is not the case, and is even insulting to insinuate that no people of color would be qualified for church leadership. What that statement is actually saying is we don't know enough people of different racial and ethnic backgrounds to actually tell them that we're hiring and conduct a search. And I think that's an indictment on the very networks that we have. And it should compel us then to reach out both personally and in terms of our professional structures to make sure that there are a diverse set of applicants for church leadership positions. And that would be just one very sort of low-hanging fruit kind of way to start to do something about the racial homogeneity, particularly in predominantly white churches.
But you know, I imagine Kamal maybe within his church saying to other like-minded members of the congregation, hey, I heard this idea of a year of jubilee for black people. And what if we gathered as members of the congregation and we pooled some resources and we led, you know, if the leader of the church isn't there yet, maybe members of the congregation are going to have to lead, for example. And I love this idea of the year of jubilee. So does what I'm talking about make sense, or does it really have to come from the top down?
I think a lot of change and progress comes from the bottom up. So there's a great book called Local People by John Dittmer, which is about the struggle for civil rights in Mississippi. And Mississippi has been called the closed society. And because of the politically and economically, it was such a rigid system. And so any change that has come in the state of Mississippi, where I go to graduate school at the University of Mississippi, any change that has come has typically come from the grassroots level. So I think that's the same can be true in churches. And what I often say as I write and speak around the country is that it doesn't take a big group. It can take a small coalition of the willing who can move the church further along toward racial equality and justice issues. So I would absolutely encourage folks in the congregation to get a small group together. It can be around a book like The Color of Compromise. It can be watching a documentary about race or history, and just let those conversations percolate and see where they go. All that being said, absolutely, this is facilitated by the leadership. And so if the leaders are on board, that's going to make the job a whole lot easier. And if the leaders are resistant, that's going to lead to some very tense but probably necessary confrontations within a congregation.
What have you found the reception among people outside of your own faith community, Jamar? What's I said at the beginning this was going to be an uncomfortable conversation. I'm interested in whether you've seen that in, I don't want to face up to this, or I don't know what to do about this. What have you seen?
I've seen, just to be very precise, people sort of agree with the history as I unfold it right up until about the 60s and the 70s. And then it gets more historically adjacent, it gets more personal, and it gets even more politicized. So there's never been really clear-cut lines between religion and politics, in spite of what anyone would say. For instance, in 1667, the Virginia Assembly, a legislative body, passes a law that says baptism does not free enslaved Africans, Native Americans, or mixed-race people. There you have race, religion, and politics all mixing in a single decision. But that gets clearer in the 60s, and especially the 70s and 80s, with the rise of the religious right. And so I find theologically and politically conservative Christians, namely white evangelicals, really resistant to the idea that politics, partisan politics, would have anything to do with the race question at all. And I think that's fundamentally ahistorical. I mean, in the book, I give quotes and names and events and institutions that are directly related to the issue of school integration, that are directly related to taxation as it relates to integration, and that being part of what coalesces a political movement that is conservative. And I'm not arguing for people to become Democrat or liberal or become Republican or conservative. Beyond that, what I'm simply saying is we need to reckon with the ways that these ideas of race and religion have expressed themselves politically in who gets elected, in what policies get promoted. And so that conversation, look, I thought the most controversial topic I could talk about is race. It's not. The most controversial topic I could talk about is politics. And that's where I see the real conflict when people are reading the book.
I thought we would close with Lecrae, the musician who wrote the foreword to The Color of Compromise. And I thank you very much for an excellent conversation, Jamar. Thank you.
People wonder, is he Walker just a new slave? Or religion, he just covered it with new change. Chopping out the church, he ain't really fake. He divisive, he don't rep the king, he just want the fame. Oh man, now they acting like I'm suddenly political. Told me shut my mouth and get my checks from evangelicals. Boy, my mama raised me on Angela and Eldridge. Chuck Berry made it, but the credit went to Elvis. No, you never knew that. No, you think I'm too black. I just think I'm too real. I grew up on Tupac. You grew up thinking that the Panthers were some terrorists. I grew up hearing how they fed my mama eggs and grits.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.